But, considering the circumstances under which this man became a vampire, would you be justified in using it? You, of all men. At this home thrust the hard-faced man Winston kept silence. It has always been my belief, said Dr. Latimer, that Justin, with all his faults, did not enter our fraternity without a reason, and it is also my belief that when he gave himself as a voluntary sacrifice to save another, he wiped out a very great deal, if not all, of his debt. Did he not contract a fresh debt when he elected to become a vampire? Asked Fordyce. Admittedly. But do you not think that he wiped that out also when he went voluntarily to the second death? Remember, we have not power to force him to surrender his wraith form. He laid it down of his own free will rather than injure one whom he loved. The second death is a terrible thing for a man in his position to face, and he had no means of knowing that the second death would reject him. And even if he had known it, interposed the third, to wander homeless in the intermediate state is a much worse thing than to burn in hell, for you suffer all the pains of purgatory with none of its purification. That soul is out on the astral now, where, between you, you have dispatched him. Now, gentlemen, as I told you before, time is the essence of the contract, for, deprived of his peculiar form of sustenance, Lucas will no longer be able to hold his physical body together, and you have just about the same time in which to act as would elapse between death and burial in the ordinary way. Lucas has returned to his grave by now, for it is past cockcrow, and he will probably return to it again tomorrow, but I doubt if he will be able to use it much longer. The correct thing to do is to bury him at Four Corners, with a stake in his side, said the hard-faced man, his sneer again getting the better of his discretion. His interlocutor looked at him sharply. Don't talk nonsense, he said. That is nothing to do with the matter. The body will disintegrate, anyway. Lucas has already renounced his vampirism. What we have to decide is, whether we will let events take their natural course and leave Lucas to wander as an earthbound spirit till his time is up, or try to get him back into his physical body, which is at present lying in deep trance in the graveyard. The old man sat up with a start. Then he is not dead, he said. By no manner of means, said the third. He has performed a very advanced yogi operation. If you were to examine his body, you would probably find that even the injuries inflicted by the post-mortem had been reconstructed. He had been out of his body some time when the death stroke fell upon it, and had evidently planned to lie in trance until he could arrange to get his body exhumed under the proper conditions, living as a vampire meanwhile. Lucas took a very long chance. It was 1,000 to 1 against his experiment succeeding, but as he had managed in holding his form together so long, there is a possibility that he might have succeeded had he continued. He is a brave man, and whatever the cruelties by which he had kept himself going, I can forgive a great deal to bravery. He paused and looked round the room, studying the effect his words had had upon his hearers. Dr. Latimer was gazing at him in eager perplexity. There could be no doubt as to the way his wishes went, but he feared to allow himself to hope too much lest the disappointment should be too keen. Lucas had meant a great deal to him, had been like a son to his lonely old age, and he had painstakingly transmitted to him all his laboriously acquired occult knowledge, hoping to see the young man accomplish the great work that had been denied to himself. The hard-faced man had lost the immobile calm of the trained occultist and had his hand at his moustache, tugging at it nervously. It was obvious that a vindictive temper was prying for the upper hand. He hated having his judgment reversed, he resented the tacit assumption of superiority by the stranger, but he appeared to consider the resistance as futile and showed signs of making good his retreat as best he could. He rose to his feet. I would give you my opinion, he said, but I don't resist your authority. The responsibility is yours. All I ask is, that you will excuse me from sharing the consequences. That is an absolution I have no power to give, replied the third. You will not see the end of the consequences of this affair for many a long life to come. But we hold no man against his will. If it is your wish to withdraw, you have my permission to do so. The hard-faced man pulled on a heavy leather motoring coat. his eyes wandering from one to another of the faces before him. For Veronica they held something that almost approached pity. The old Dr. Latimer, he gave a glance of resentment and contempt. The eyes of the third he was unable to meet. Nevertheless, he addressed him. "Things may turn out as you expect," he said, "or they may not. Lucas may have succeeded in eluding the Dark Ray, or he may not. But in any case, I wish him joy of the leavings of the post-mortem." With which parting shot he closed the door behind him, and they heard his footsteps die away through the empty, echoing house. "That, of course," said the third, "is the crux of the matter. What has the post-mortem left? We cannot tell that till we open the grave. Our immediate practical problem is, how to get the grave open. There is one person, however, who has got to be consulted before we commence this undertaking. Now, Miss Mannering, what is your feeling about the matter? Do you wish to stand clear of it, also?" Veronica gazed at him, unable to reply for a moment. The thought of meeting Lucas quickened her pulses and brought a faint flush to her cheeks, but the fear of what such a meeting might mean closed like a cold hand about her heart. The dark hawk's eyes of the strange man before her watched her compassionately, but he made no attempt to help her. It was her deepest instincts that had to give the answer, and no influence must be used to sway the surface. But Veronica's answer was a foregone conclusion. She had gone too far down this path to turn back, and the karma of a million years was behind her. "I will stand by, Justin," she said, using the Christian name of her sinister lover for the first time. "For I think he will need me when he comes back." "I think so, too," said the third. "In fact, it would have served little purpose of bringing him back without you, but the decision had to be free. Pity and duty are no substitutes for love." He looked at the watch on his wrist. "It has just gone 3, the sun rises at 7:30. We have, therefore, about 3 hours between now and second cockcrow to do that which we have to do." "How are we to get the grave opened?" inquired Dr. Latimer. "We have no time to get an order from the Home Office, and clandestine digging is impractical." "There are more ways of opening a grave than with a spade," said the mysterious man with the hawk-like eyes. "Have you got your robes with you?" "Of course," said the old man, and taking one of the bedroom candles departed into the drafty darkness of the whispering, creaking house. The solitary remaining candle did no more than make the darkness palpable in the big room with its shadowy furniture. The man who called himself the third sat for a while gazing silently into the dying fire, the dull red glow from its embers throwing strange lights and shadows on his rugged features, making him look like a grotesque idol carved by some forgotten race. He seemed far away in the depths of thought, oblivious of his remaining companion, and Veronica was able to study him at her leisure, wondering what manner of discipline had made him the man he was. Suddenly he looked up, and crossing the hearth rug, sat down on a chair close beside hers, taking her hand in his. "My child," he said. "Do you realize what lies before you? Have you any understanding of the matter?" Veronica gave him her slow Mona Lisa smile. "I understand better than you think," she said. "I have known these things before." "And you remember?" "Yes, I see you do." "That is good, very good. I believe we shall be able to carry this thing through with your assistance. To rouse Lucas from his trance is a simple enough matter, but to make him live afterwards, ah, that is the problem. You will have to marry him, my child. Do you realize that? And the mating of an occultist is much more than the ordinary marrying. You will have to mate with him in the unseen as well as on the earth, and in the unseen, you must be the male force, you must be the controller. Your spiritual nature has got to marry his intellect, and you must fertilize it, not be fertilized by it. Do you understand that? You cannot lean on him in the inner planes. By sheer spirituality you have got to take the lead. His mind must never get the upper hand again. Your spiritual nature must be the dominant. Child that you are, can you do it? Can you hold a man of that type by his ideals? Veronica withdrew her eyes from his and gazed far off into the shadows. Could she do what was required of her? or had she in her ignorance committed herself to tasks utterly beyond her capacity? No one knew her weaknesses better than Veronica did. She was only too well aware of the simplicity and inexperience that made her a ready prey to the designing, of the diffidence that prevented her from giving effect even to that which she knew, and the lack of self-confidence that held her helpless and inarticulate. Yet within her there was a curious sense of power. Little, bright, clear-cut pictures, like the images seen through the wrong end of a pair of opera glasses, broke and reformed before her eyes in an ever-shifting kaleidoscope. The portico of a temple, with its great pillars sparkling white in the sun, then the bowed, silent congregation within, the drifting incense and the shifting lights, then the darkness of the Holy of Holies, with the coals in the tripod glowing redly and the dim forms of elemental spirits shaping themselves in the fume. The man's hands held hers in a grip of iron, his eyes burned themselves into her brain. "Oh, Pythonus," he said, "can you not remember?" She looked at him with eyes that seemed to gaze through deep water, but as the light cleared, she saw that about his face were forming the folds of the striped headdress of Egypt. Behind him rose the shadow of a vast pylon. His hands crushed hers as his will rove into her, and she could feel the burning heat of them against her skin. "O priestess of Isis, have you forgotten?" His voice boomed and rolled like a drum through the room. The shadowy pylon behind him came clear for a moment in rose-red sandstone, then changed into another, though similar, type of masonry, more roughly hewn, though white as milk. Far below her, as if seen from a precipice, the huddled roofs of houses, covered with some yellow metal that was not gold, gleamed dully through the sick, misty air, and the sun hung large in the heavens, like a disk of copper. "Helios, Helios, Quantara Pantanic," breathed the voice in her ear, and all lost Atlantis awoke to the chant of the sun god. She saw the great processions of the white-clad priests and remembered the part she had taken in them. She saw the smoke rise from the sacred volcano, and knew what her function was, and she heard her voice answer in the antiphon, "Quantara Odophane, Helion." She sprang to her feet and threw up her hands in the salute of the Sunday. The ancient invocation to the great initiator sprang to her lips. "What thou my soul down the river of Ladder? Bring it to light, and to life, and to love." The man who was called the third rose from his chair and gave the answering salute. Through all the changes of the vision, his face had been the one thing that had not changed. Under Egyptian Nemesis or Atlantean Philae, it had been the same. He looked deeply into her eyes. "Do you remember me?" he said.
"Yes," she answered.
"By what name did you call me last?" "You were known to us as the Count." He nodded, and the tenseness went from his attitude as he relaxed the efforts of will he had been making. At that moment the door opened and Dr. Latimer entered, bearing a small black bag in his hand. He laid it on the table beside another of similar shape and size that evidently belonged to the newcomer. Then, without instruction, he assisted the man who was called the third, and also the Count, to shift the furniture into the corners of the room and clear a floor space. Then he knelt in the middle and held one end of a thread while his companion drew out a circle with a limp of putty-like substance attached to the other end, which left a luminous mark upon the floor, as of some phosphorus compound. "What sigils?" said he, taking another lump of the same stuff out of his black bag. "Put the signs and seals of the princes of the powers of the air," replied the other. "I am going to invoke the spirits of tempest. What we cannot dig up we may be able to wash out, as the grave is almost on the bank of the river." Veronica was reminded of the famous floorcloth that Lucas had told her about, the thing that first turned his thought to the study of occultism. The old man left his companion to complete the hieroglyphs, and put a small piece of some black substance on the glowing embers of the hearth. When it began to smolder, he took it up with tongs and placed it in a copper terrible of antique workmanship, and sprinkled what looked like fine gravel upon it. A dense cloud of smoke went up instantly, filling the room with aromatic odors and curling into fantastic forms as the drafts took it. He delivered the little censer into the hands of Veronica. "You must take charge of this," he said, "and you must on no account let it go out. keep it swinging gently all the time. They turned to see that the other man had lifted a small table into the center of the circle and draped it with a black cloth into the semblance of an altar. In a little bowl of ruby glass a floating wick showed a point of flame as it swam on the surface of the sacred oil, its light fell with a ruddy glow on certain metallic objects of peculiar shape that were disposed around it. Veronica's attention was distracted for a moment by the sensor in her charge, from which the smoke had ceased to issue, and mindful of Dr. Latimer's warning, she swung it back and forth till the glowing charcoal once more set the incense smoldering. She looked up to find that a change had occurred in the room. The personality of Dr. Latimer had completely disappeared under the flowing black robe and cowl of an inquisitor which he had assumed, but the individuality of the third was revealed rather than hidden by his robes, for his cowl was pushed back to frame the face, and upon his head he wore the royal headdress of Egypt. He came towards Veronica holding out a similar robe to that which shrouded Dr. Latimer. "This you must wear," he said, "for you will need protection in that which we are about to do." Veronica, completely enveloped in the flowing black draperies of the voluminous garment, felt strangely cut off from the world. It had evidently been used for rituals before, for its folds were full of the smell of incense. "Now," said the third, "we are ready. Have we got everything? We can't step outside the circle once we have started, you know." He came towards Veronica. "This is your place," he said. "Whenever you have finished a circumambulation, come back here, and be sure and keep the sensor going. There is more incense in that box. The charcoal ought to last out all right. Always go round the way of the sun. Be sure you never get into the reverse circumambulation. Don't try and cut across the circle. Whatever happens, keep going round, and whatever you do, don't step outside that line. Get the sensor going well, and then walk three times round the circle in the way of the sun." He returned to the altar, taking his stand with his back to the east, immediately in front of it. The light from the floating wick threw into strong relief the rugged lines of his face, and the hawk-like eyes, deep set under heavy brows, flashed with an unnatural fire. The long black lines of his draperies added to his height and made him look gigantic in the shifting shadows, and the golden headdress of Egypt, with the serpent rising as if to strike from above the brow, seemed the fitting crown for a face that was neither young nor old, but strangely deathless in its calm, as if all the races of the earth had risen and fallen before its unaging wisdom and power. He raised his arms above his head to their full extent, and a great shadow followed him across the ceiling. In his right hand he held a sword, and the towering figure in the flashing blade seemed gigantic among the shadows. The Kabbalistic cross of purification was marked on brow and breast, and a strange stillness fell upon the room. At a sign from him, Veronica set out upon her task of pacing the circle. The cowl stifled her, she could see out of the eyeholes with difficulty, the incense rose in clouds into her face as she moved, and at every step she found an increased difficulty in balancing. To walk that circle was no simple task, for she seemed to be pushing her way through invisible currents. The second time round, however, was easier, and at the third round a force seemed to push her along, and when she returned to the station assigned to her, she saw that a circle of fire now shone where she had walked. It appeared and disappeared as she gazed at it, and she could not make out what it was that she saw. At first she thought it was an optical illusion, then she thought that something had actually caught fire, and finally she realized that what she saw was not of this earth, and appeared and disappeared as her consciousness wavered between two planes. The third dropped the point of his sword upon the symbol on the altar and began the chant of evocation. Vibrant names of harsh consonants rang out into the darkness as demon after demon was reminded of his oath and conjured from the abyss to come to the service of the Magus. By the secret names of God were they conjured, and by the names of the great archangels of the elements. And as each name rang out in resonant syllables the atmosphere of the room changed perceptibly. Demons of storm, princes of the powers of the air, vice-regents of the elements. He called them all by name. "O fiends of the abyss, remember your oath upon the symbol.
O dark and mighty ones, remember who calls upon you. The night without was still, pitch dark, and frosty. There was no sound within but the faint shifting of logs on the hearth and the perpetual creaking and whispering of the old house settling upon its timbers. Both men stood like statues, and Veronica, old memories stirring within her, maintained the same stillness, for she had worked ritual magic before, and knew the discipline that teaches immobility. The evocation ended, dead silence fell upon the room. Force seemed to be pouring in a river of light down the sword onto the symbol, and the figure of the magician was like a dynamo, vibrating with the power of its invisible speed. A faint sigh of wind in the treetops at length broke the stillness, then it came again more strongly, and they heard the scurry of dead leaves over the frosty ground. It was not the kind of night for a thunderstorm, but Veronica was put in mind of the sudden wind that heralds the thunder. Again the wind rose with a wailing moan, and the snapping of dead twigs in the shrubberies could distinctly be heard above it. And then, without any warning, the crackling volley of thunder broke out immediately overhead, and rain came down in torrents. Veronica had never seen such rain. It had the violence of a tropical storm, and falling upon the frost-bound ground, it ran straight off down every slope in sheets of water. All about them they could hear the sound of water on the move, and before many minutes had passed, the voice of the river had changed its note. With the outbreaking of the thunder the tense forces of the room seemed to be released. It was as if the power generated by the invocations had passed from the altar into the cloud, but to be released is as lightning and tempest. The two men relaxed their vigilance, and going to the soul window, stood watching the storm. As the lightning lit up the sky in flickering sheets, they could see the river through the gaps in the trees. It drove before the wind like a miniature sea and had already risen to cover the road. Suddenly a faraway roaring, like a train going over a viaduct, fell upon their ears above the din of the storm. It came steadily nearer, as if some heavy vehicle were charging down the cart track beside the river, and then into their line of vision came a wall of dark water edged with foam that rushed along the surface of the river with the speed of an express train. Good heavens, what's that? Exclaimed both men simultaneously. They had evidently bargained for no such manifestation. In the heaving billows behind the line of foam great timbers rose and fell like the lances of a charging army, part of a hayrick went past, and then a farm cart, turning over and over. A dam must have gone somewhere upstream, said Dr. Latimer, and a big sluice gate, coming down flat like a raft, confirmed his words. Lucas, terrible in death, was even more terrible in resurrection. Quick, exclaimed the third, we haven't a moment to lose. Heaven knows what that floodwater has done in the graveyard, and out he went into the raging, buffeting darkness. Veronica, clutching her censer as if her life depended on it, went after him, the old man, still cowled, close upon her heels. They made their way through the tormented woods, guided by the squat tower of the church that stood out against the darkness at each lightning flash. The trees screamed, roared, crashed, and shuddered, branches came down like javelins, and the water ran ankle-deep over the frozen ground that it could not penetrate. It was undoubtedly the frost-bound earth that had caused the catastrophe, for all the water that fell in the valley ran straight down every slope into the river. Thunder rain usually falls upon parched ground that absorbs a vast quantity before any is thrown off. But frozen ground can absorb nothing, and rain runs off it as off a roof. They stumbled across the fallen stones of the graveyard wall and found themselves under the lee of the church. The ground rose slightly towards the graveyard, and the road ran beside the river was cut out of the slope. The swollen river was deep on the road, and raced madly along the retaining wall that held up the face of the bank, and as they approached the spot where Lucas lay, a great spout of foam went up high in the air as a long section of wall, its foundations undermined, fell into the river. Here it is, cried Veronica's tumbling over a low mound of rough earth that lay at the very edge of the water. Be careful. Come back, cried Dr. Latimer, seizing her arm.
More of the bank may go at any minute. It is going now, said the third, and even as he spoke, another mass of the bank peeled away, and Veronica had a glimpse of some dark object sticking out of the yellow clay as the moon broke fitfully through the racing clouds. It slowly tilted as the earth was cut from under it by the water, and the loose clods above, washed away in the downpour, revealed the long dark outline of a coffin, which slowly upended and slid towards the river. With one spring the third was into the washed-out grave and seized the metal handle at the coffin head that gleamed dully in the moonlight. The bank was crumbling fast, but he stood his ground, and Veronica heard a sound of splintering wood as he forced open the lid of the coffin with some metal tool. The wood was cheap and frail and yielded easily, and as the water reached him, he clambered out of the grave bearing in his powerful arms a long white form, and a flash of lightning revealed to Veronica the features of Lucas, serene in death but unmarred by corruption, swathed in the stained cerements of the desecrated grave. Chapter 14. They made their way back through the roaring darkness. The flickering lightning revealed sudden glimpses of the churchyard, with its rows of headstones and black writhing yew trees rent by the storm. The ground was sodden by now, and the two men slipped and staggered with their burden, leaving Veronica to follow as best she could, still clutching the censer, which for some unknown reason, had managed to remain alight. The girl hoped and prayed that no one would look out from the upper windows of the cottages and see them in the fitful moonlight. What they would make of the black-robed, ghoulish procession, she could not guess, but she knew it would certainly be attributed to the Grange, and even that stolid countryside had reached the point when it was nearly ready for a lynching. They were still far from the shelter of the wood when her fears were realized. She heard a window thrown up in the neighboring darkness. Then she heard a door open and shut. So far as she could judge, the sound came down the wind. Indeed, it could hardly have been heard from the contrary direction, and she guessed that it came from the house of Dr. Butler, whose garden abutted on the churchyard. "Hurry, hurry," she cried to her companions. "Someone is coming." They struggled on towards the shelter of the wood, guided by the line of tormented yew trees, and as they passed the gap in the wall, Veronica, gazing over her shoulder in terrified apprehension, saw the flash of an electric torch by the corner of the church. Her companions hurried on, but Veronica paused. She felt that she must see who came and what was discovered. The moon broke through a rift in the clouds, and she distinctly saw a bulky figure clad in the white mackintosh that Dr. Butler often wore. What strange fatality, what invisible link caused this man invariably to appear when anything was toward with regard to Lucas? She saw him pause suddenly, as if he had heard something. He looked about him as if trying to identify the direction of the sound. She wondered what it could be. Then he set off and made a straight line towards the place where she was hidden. An eddy of wind from the lee of the woods had carried to him the odor of the incense from the censer she still bore with her. She crouched among the bushes like a hunted creature, petrified, unable to move. The man came on till he was some 30 feet from the edge of the trees, and paused irresolute. The eddying drafts around the yew trees had carried the telltale fragrance away. He was not a primitive savage, and his nose gave him no sure information. She saw him stand there irresolute, and then, believing himself to be alone in the darkness, he lifted his arms above his head and poured out an incoherent mixture of prayer and cursing in which her own name mingled with that of Lucas and Alec. Then he turned and stumbled off over the grave mounds in the direction of his home, taking with him his grief and his suspicions to brood over in silence. Veronica rose from her hiding place and followed the half-obliterated path through the woods, a sudden realization coming to her that she was alone in the darkness and storm with all the unseen presences of the abyss let loose about her. The storm was not merely a hurricane of wind and rain, it was unspeakably sinister, like hands reaching out from the shadows, and the darkness was palpable, like veil upon veil of soft black woven stuff. But even as she realized the subtle intangible influences abroad in the night, a change began to make itself felt. The howling tumult of the storm was being penetrated by a musical note, which gradually dominated its numberless discordant voices. Slowly they were dominated, gradually they were drawn into tune, then the rhythmical singing itself fell silent and all was still. The storm had died away as suddenly as it had arisen.